Okay, Boker Tov. Good morning, everybody. We're getting through the early stages of the Megillah, and I'm going to stay with the historical approach. We've been talking from the point of view of history, and as we've discovered, it gives a whole different flavor to the Megillah, a whole different approach to the story. And one of the things that we've tried to establish is the reality that maybe Mordechai and Esther, the beginning of the story, not necessarily by the end, but at the beginning of the story, maybe communal people, in the sense they're part of a bigger community in Shushan, but not necessarily the great spiritual leaders that they are described as, that we've always considered them to be. One example is what we're going to read now, which is the famous plot. All right, if you're on page 1254, 1254, and it's verse 21. And I'm going to say more about this when we get the repetition of it in chapter 6. But here in chapter 2, the famous plot against the king. All right, and again, we've got to establish a time frame. The time frame that we saw was that Esther was, in fact, chosen in the seventh year, right, of Achashverosh. We said it was the seventh year. So again, when we put numbers on it, he started his reign 486. And now we're talking about the year 479. Esther was chosen. And the whole story with Haman, which starts in chapter 3, is going to be literally another 5 years down the line. So you've got the story of choosing a queen, which began in the seventh year, and Haman coming along and making his plea to the king to kill the Jews, that's in the 12th year. Right? So you've got now, again, another 5 year period of consolidation. It's interesting how the Megillah, when you put numbers on it, and the Megillah itself gives you these numbers, but we don't think of it like that. We think of it as one intense, short story, and it really isn't. Beginning to end, the whole story runs for about 12 years. All right? If we're running from essentially the third year of Achashverosh, right through until the 12th year of Achashverosh, which is the story that we're going to read in chapter 3, then we've got 9 years between the banquet, when the Jews went to eat food, and the resolution of the story in the 12th year of Achashverosh's reign, when Mordechai and Esther, you know, step up to the plate and everybody else, and it becomes Napoch, it becomes a victory. So you've got essentially a 9 year time frame for the story of the Megillat Esther, which again is something which we need to bear in mind. It's a long period of time. And in fact, the rabbis are aware of this, and they always ask the obvious question, why did the Jews deserve to be destroyed 9 years after the moment when they let the side down, they went to the banquet? It was 9 years later before this whole business with Haman came about. So again, Achashverosh 486, the first banquet 483, the story of Esther choosing a wife 479, and then you've got a 5 year period before you get to 476, which is the period of chapter 3 when Haman comes along and he starts his shenanigans. So between the beginning, essentially, of Achashverosh in 486, and Haman, one second again, we said that Haman starts his thing in 476, essentially, right? So that's 10 years. The Megillah talks about the poor, the whole thing of the lottery was in the 12th year, I think it says. It says in the 12th year of the reign of Achashverosh. The 12th year. So pages 1254. I'm just trying to get the timeline correct in my own mind. Let's just do it one more time. You've got Achashverosh beginning 486. You've got him holding his banquet in 483. You've then got a 4 year gap when he has all the wars. And it's 7 years into his reign, 479. Right? Which is the moment when Esther begins the process of trying to become the queen, or being taken to the palace to become the queen. And then the Megillah says 5 years later, 474, wasn't doing the math right, 474, which is 12 years after Achashverosh begins his reign, That's when the story of Haman comes to a head and the events of chapter 3 through to the end of the Megillah. Alright, so basically the Megillah runs really essentially a 12-year time frame, but it's actually year 3 of Achashverosh, so you minus 12 minus 3, you start off at the 3rd year of Achashverosh, so you've got a 9-year time frame for the whole of the story of Megillat Esther. Okay, from beginning to end, 9 years. If necessary, what I'll do next week, if I remember, just do a little diagram to put those numbers, you know, down in front of you. Here we're looking again at a period when there is this rebellion, this minor rebellion against the king. And the rabbis are very, very perplexed. Why now? Lamach Shah. And one of the suggestions is because Mordechai is now promoted to his elevated position. As we saw, Mordechai Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech. Now, we always understood Mordechai sitting in the gate of the king, maybe because of his position as the most learned Jew in the country, was a sign that the king, when the king was looking for advice or whatever, instead of going to his own people, Esther had said to him, why don't you bring my uncle Mordechai into the palace? He'll advise you better. That's one suggestion, that Mordechai was brought in by Esther. Because once Esther is chosen, I guess she can ask the king for a favor. And one of the favors she may have asked is to bring Mordechai into the palace. That's if you go with the general concept, Mordechai being what we call the Rosh Yeshiva. He was the spiritual leader of the day. However, Rav Lau says maybe not. Maybe we're talking about Mordechai being a very well-connected communal leader. Not necessarily a great spiritual leader, but at this point in time, someone who represents the higher level of achievement in the community, but not someone who is known for his religious, you know, sort of fervor, his religious stand. On the contrary, it could be that Mordechai here is just someone who is sitting in the palace of the king, because, again, you can say Esther brought him in, but not necessarily he's there because of his great Torah knowledge. It could be just because he is there because he is Esther's mishpucha, right? And she's pulled what they call in Israel some protexia. She's managed to get him a job. So Rav Lau basically wants to follow the second line, because he says the concept of the rabbi sitting in the gate of the palace of the king is very difficult to comprehend. In the society in Persia, it would be very unusual that they would give prominence to such a person in the palace of the king. He would have his own place, he would have his own office downtown, somewhere, but not necessarily as it's described again and again, Yoshev B'Sha'ar HaMelech. He's sitting in the palace of the king. So the suggestion is that maybe Mordechai at this point is still the secular-based Jew. He knows he's Jewish. He's got his secular name, Marduk, which is a name, a Persian name. Esther has still got her Persian connection, and she's won the beauty contest. She's elevated herself to a position of achievement. She's brought Mordechai into the palace. And now Mordechai is sitting there, and he overhears a conversation. The rabbis, of course, play on the first approach, that he is the Rosh Yeshiva, because they say, being a member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court, he had to know 70 languages. And if he knew 70 languages, he understood what these two gentlemen, the plotters, Bigtan and Teresh, what they were saying. Because they were speaking in Tarshish, whatever that is, Persian or Turkish or something, whatever it was. But again, you can say that Mordechai was just very well educated. Right? He went to college, he had a good education. He was also, remember, we're going to talk about this today, he was in the Persian army. So there's no question about it, there are two different approaches to the status of Mordechai at this stage. Is he the greatest recognizable Jew in the community? Or is he someone who happens to be Jewish, who has elevated himself to the point where he can sit without reservation in the palace of the king and be there at the crucial moment when he overhears this conversation about killing the king? So what I'm trying to show you is that there still are two ways of understanding the position of Mordechai and essentially the position of Esther as well. One which I would call more traditional, and one which I now try to explain to you is really more historical. Right? It makes more sense in the historical perspective for Mordechai not to be the quintessential Jew at this point, but to be someone who is there, who has Jewish connections, but is not famous for being Jewish, but is famous for being smart, right? He's famous for being clever. He's famous for knowing his stuff. He's a good advisor, okay? Many governments have people like that in government, and advisors and all the rest of it. They're there, but the fact that they're Jewish, okay. You know, we now heard that Mayor Bloomberg is now going to run for president. So he happens to be Jewish. How Jewish? Very, very, I would say, not very Jewish. But he maybe goes to shul 3 times a year. But the point is that his Jewishness may become an issue, may not. But he's there, not because he's Jewish, but he's there because he's Mayor Bloomberg. He knows his stuff, right? He's run companies and he's a multi-billionaire. So all of that becomes the main focus, and that may be what Mordechai is, the original Bloomberg candidate. Who knows? I don't know. But listen to this, chapter 2, verse 21. And it's about 3/4 of the way down on page 1254. Verse 21. Bayomimahem, in those days, Mordechai Yoshev B'Sha'am Melech, just again reminding us that Mordechai is sitting in the palace of the king, in the gate. Katzav Bigtam V'Teresh Shnei Sarisei HaMelech Mishomer HaSav. There were two officers of the king. They were angry. V'Yevakshu Lishloach Liyah B'Melech HaShvirosh. They want to kill the king. And the rabbis say that really they wanted to kill Mordechai. They were jealous. Because Mordechai was elevated and he got to the top of the tree almost without any effort, right? He was brought in, as they say, because he's related to the right person. He happens to be a very clever man. He happens to be a smart man. But the reality was that it creates jealousy, especially in the Persian world. And these two guys really wanted to kill Mordechai. But you know what? If already the king had agreed, let's go for the king. Let's go for the main man. That's one of the suggestions of the rabbi. They don't hold back when it comes to plot, subplot, and all the rest of it. It's very, very interesting. But that's just a suggestion. But look what they do. Pasuk 22. Vayivodah davar leMordechai. Mordechai became known to Mordechai, right? What was going on? Vayaged leEsther haMalkah. And he told to Esther what he had overheard. And vatom Esther laMelech b'shem Mordechai. This wonderful statement. She told the king in the name of Mordechai. And again, is it the name of Mordechai HaYehudi, or is it the name of Mordechai Stam, as they say, without the title Mordechai Yehudi? He's not called Mordechai Yehudi. It's just Mordechai, my uncle overheard this conversation, my cousin, or whatever the relationship was, and I am reporting as the queen to you, Achashverosh, what my uncle overheard. And at this point, Vayivukasha Davar Matsesha Tolu Shnei Malaitz, they both were hanged on the tree. And it got written down. One comment that, again, Rav Lau makes in some of the other commentaries, they say, at this point, Mordechai is almost untouchable. Because look what happened. He's now the king's confidant. Because he stopped people killing the king. If he stopped people killing the king, then, you know, he's in a good position. Yeah. Yeah.
Why didn't
it all happen?
And then he's, I remember I never paid Mordechai back for that.
Yeah. There's a whole commentary on what's going on here. And there are different suggestions why the reward was not given at that particular time. It's too long to go into. The Malbim goes in a great length about it, and it's worth reading. There is a Malbim in English on Megillat Esther. You probably got it home somewhere. And it's beautiful. And he does explain that there's miracle upon miracle upon miracle that's going on at this point. And one of the miracles is that, in fact, Mordechai is not immediately rewarded. It's sort of held in abeyance, so that when it comes to the point later on, when it's going to be relevant, it becomes relevant. You see what I'm saying? It's held back. And there's no obvious explanation why the king held back, except say, write it, you know, got written down, and nothing was done at that moment, but that became something that you put, you know, on hold. It was a credit for Mordechai. And that is part of the miracle of the story, because it sets up the whole interaction now between Haman, Mordechai, and Achashverosh. So that's one suggestion. But, you know, you have to look in the Malbim. He's got tons of things to say. It's a great question. Yeah. And
the investigation sort of like put aside
and put aside the whole thing. That's another suggestion. And there are many, many options here. And it is intriguing that, you know, at this point, you didn't write him a check. Yeah, write him a check. Buy him a house in Florida. You know, do something. Show your appreciation. Or wherever they would buy the house. You know what I'm saying? It's not happening at this point. But of course, when you put the whole equation of Yad Hashem into all of this, it begins to, once you go to the end, you begin to realize this is all the way the story is building up slowly but surely. But as I said, there is a lot to say. If you've got the Judaica one that I mentioned to you, he's got a whole page and a half on this, on that particular point. So it's certainly worth looking at. Correct. And of course, the rabbis ask the question, and they say that this is the, as they say, there is what is called the refuah before the makkah. That the cure is mentioned before the ailment, before the disease. So Mordechai and the whole story of Bigtan Vateresh becomes the cure, because that becomes the reason why the king believes Mordechai. Right, Mordechai is now untouchable. You can't do away with Mordechai. You think about it, if Haman hated Mordechai so much, why didn't he just snap his fingers? Mordechai would be killed. The answer is because Mordechai's got diplomatic immunity. There's no question about it. Right, and that came from the story of the end of chapter 2. But what it does say, that once that has been established, then Haman comes along. But of course, before we lose heart by seeing Haman becoming elevated and doing what he wants to do, there's already a cure in the process, in the pipeline. Alright? And that's kind of interesting. The whole flow of the Megillah over here is really very significant. I want to go on to chapter 3, because here is the most fundamental question. This is the page I gave you, and I want to go through this, because it really is quite extraordinary. The story develops. Achar Devarim Ha'ele, which is again on page 1254, about 6 lines from the bottom. After these things, whatever Devarim Ha'ele means, right, whether it was soon after or not so soon, right, if you think the plot was sometime during that 5-year period, which we spoke about from 479 to 474, it was a 5-year period, so when the plot took place, could have been any time during those 5 years. So, achar devarim ha'ela, after these matters came about, then, gidal ha-melech achshveresh et haman ben amdata agagi v'ayinaseh, Haman was elevated, he also worked his way, he advanced his way through to the top of the Persian civil service, or whatever you want to call it. He was raised, some say that he had an elevated chair, because that's the way you showed it in those days. You know, everyone sat at different levels according to the height of the chair that they were on. So Haman's throne, as it were, was raised up, right? That's one suggestion why it says, Vayinaseh, he raised him up. Vayosem et kiso, it says he put his chair above everybody else, and this is the raising of Haman. Now, at this point, one of the benefits to Haman, or one of the perks of the job, was that anyone in the gates, Karim Mishtachavim LaHaman, would bow down to Haman. Ki kein tzivo lo HaMelech, this was what the king had said, that part of the respect that has to be shown to this man is in terms of bowing down to him. And of course the rabbis add the little rider, which is not mentioned here, is that he wore a kind of idolatrous ornament around his neck. Okay, so it was a double whammy. When you bow down to Haman, you ended up bowing down to his idol, which is a whole discussion which we'll come back to in a few minutes. Just a little story. My father-in-law, Zichron Livrocha, in London, got a degree from London University. He got all the degrees you can imagine. He was very, very well known in the world of computers many years ago. And about 20 years ago, he got a degree from London University. And the degree was bestowed on him by Princess Anne. If you're following The Crown, you'll know all about Princess Anne. She's come out in the new series of The Crown. And Princess Anne, at the time, she gave the various degrees. And of course, she starts off with the BAs and the MA. So he's sitting there for about 2.5 hours waiting to be... They put on a special cloak and they put a hat on him, and it's a whole performance. My wife was there and she took pictures. It was very interesting. But what his shyly, he went to his role before the event, and he says he was told that one of the things he has to do is that there's a stool in front of Princess Anne and he has to kneel down on the stool. And he wanted to know, would he be allowed to do so? That was his question, because is it an act of Let's use the word Avodah Zorah. Is it idolatry? It's a very interesting question. And he went to his Rav in London, who said, absolutely allow. And in fact, there's a whole Maram al-Kasha, there's a whole very famous tshuva about this in the 1500s. And it was okay. And he did actually bow down at that point, put his knees on the stool, she put the cap on his head, and Shalom Yisrael, and we had the Kiddush, and everybody was happy. The guy in front of him was a Sikh, also becoming a doctor of science. He refused to kneel. He was very machmeh. He was really machmeh. He did not put his knees down on the stool. Very interesting. He held himself like a stool, a small stool with handles, and he held himself on the handles but didn't put his knees down. You know, he was much more religious, let's put it that way. I don't know, different way of looking at the world. So it's so interesting that this idea of ishtachavoy, of bowing down, is something, you know, as I said, I saw this sort of in real life. And it certainly has significance, symbolic or otherwise. But listen to this. Back to the story. So here comes the bombshell. Mordechai, it says about Mordechai, lo yichra velo yishtachaveh. He won't bow his knee and he won't bow down. And says the Ibn Ezra, and I'll read you the Ibn Ezra, which I've got in front of me. He says that Mordechai did not do it because he said, ki hu hasur lo. He said this was forbidden for him to do, and I'll just read it out. The question, v'hinei yesh lishol. I've got an absolutely difficult, impossible question to ask. Lama hichnes Mordechai atzmo b'sakana. Mordechai is putting his life in danger over here. Gam hichnes kol Yisrael. And he's not only endangering himself, but all the Jewish people by not bowing down. Haya ra'ui, it's a short phrase, I'll just finish it. Sheyidaber le'Esther, it would be better that he would tell Esther, v'tasirenu mishar ha-melech, to get him out of the gate of the king, v'lo yachis sedom, in other words, avoid the problem by taking a vacation for a few weeks. Haman is coming in, and he's stomping around as if he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and you, Mordechai, are making a statement, and you're not bowing down to him. Surely, tell Esther about it, that what Mordechai will happen to Mordechai is that he takes a break and he doesn't anger Haman, and we don't have all of this built up anger, not only against Mordechai but eventually against the Jewish people. What possesses Mordechai to make such an incredible statement of refusing to bow down? Right? He's endangering himself, and says the Ibn Ezra, he's endangering his people. Very, very difficult question. And he says, the Ibn Ezra says, no, you couldn't take a break. Why? Because it had to be with the command of the king. It wasn't that Esther could give him permission to leave the palace, it had to be the king. And the king will not want him to go, because the king likes Mordechai. He wants to hear his etzi, he wants to hear what he's got to say. So the reality of it is that Mordechai is stuck. He's stuck in the palace. He can't leave the palace. And at this point, he's making a statement to the world. I'm never going to bow down to Haman. And of course, the question is why? Why is Mordechai so insistent? When in this case, you'll have to say that, you know, it's so strange that he's stirring up trouble in such a direct way. You would ask, you know, is this really a benefit? Is this really something, not only a benefit, is this something which is allowed? Isn't he endangering other people? I can be very, sort of to myself, you know, be very strict and say that I'm doing it for myself and it's only me who's affected. But in this case, Mordechai is affecting everybody else. He's making a statement, lo yichra, not just in the past, but in the future. I'm never going to bow down. What's going on here? What is the interaction between Mordechai and Haman which makes Mordechai so, as you say in Ivrit, dafka, makes him a dafkanik? He wants to show that he will never bow down to this man. What is going on here? And this is the page I gave you, and I want to go through this because this is fascinating. There are three approaches to this particular question. And I'll go through, it's a double-sided page, we won't go through the whole thing, but I'll show you how, this is taken again from Rav Lau, how it is playing out, because it's very interesting. We all know an answer to this question. And it's what Rav Lau is going to call the religious approach. As I said before, Mordechai is not going to bow down to Haman because he's wearing the idolatry around his neck. You don't bow down to idolatry, period. And that is the religious approach. But again, is that really the whole story? Is it that, or is it more than that? Because again, you'll say to me, as Ibn Ezra says, so take a break. Don't be in the palace when Mordecai comes, when Haman comes through. Do something, you know, get out of his way. It seems that Mordecai is in his faith. He's making this push towards Haman in a way which is so aggressive that we have to ask why Mordecai is doing it. And if we take on the point that he's not yet the great religious figure, but he is the quintessential sort of person in the palace who happens to be Jewish. But the reality of it is, he's there because of his wisdom, etc., etc. And then it really is very difficult. What is really bugging him at this point that he puts his own life in danger, and without realizing, maybe at the beginning, he's endangering the Jewish people? Why does he make such a stand about not bowing down to Haman? Now you'll say to me, wait a minute, there are cases like this. I remember watching a movie about the Warsaw Ghetto. And one of the things that the Nazis did to belittle the Jews in the ghetto was that any time a Nazi officer was coming towards you and you were on the sidewalk, you had to go into the gutter. And they insisted that people walked in the gutter. That's how disgusting they were. And there are many stories about some Jews who were so offended by this and were so upset by this that they refused. Sometimes even at the cost of their lives, because the Nazi could just shoot him. One of the examples the movie showed, this is a very interesting movie about the Warsaw Ghetto, was what Mordechai Nilevich, the leader of the rebellion, the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, he refused to get off the pavement. He would stand there, he would confront the Nazi, and in that scene, the Nazi just walks on, doesn't do anything. But that he was taking a chance. And he's with a friend, and the friend says to him, Mordechai, what are you doing? He's going to kill you. And he says, he won't. He was convinced, he was sure, if you stand up to them, that you can actually fight them. And of course, that became the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. But that's an extreme situation. And you think about it, we're not in Warsaw Ghetto circumstance at this point. There's no issue here at the moment of the Jews being in danger at this point in chapter 3 of the Megillah. Not until Mordechai seems to start the ball rolling. And Haman then decides, well, I'm going to punish the whole lot of them. And then it becomes what we know as an attack on the Jewish people. So this again, good morning. So this is very, very challenging why Mordechai is so aggressive against Haman. So listen to this. This is really, really something special. Just give you this page. Now, again, this is the question of Ibn Ezra and Cesar of Lao. It's other people have asked the same question. what I'm going to do is read from the second paragraph, Ulam. It's on the right-hand side on page 1. Where it says at the top, chapter 3, Rav Lau, Haman Mordechai, three approaches on the page that I just gave you. And it's the second paragraph. The first paragraph, he just puts the time frame, as we said, that there is, we're talking about years 7 till year 12. During that time period, which is what we're referring to here, when finally in year 12 of the reign of Ahasuerus, that's when Haman throws the dice and everything starts happening. But before that, there's the story of Bigtan and Teresh and Esther being chosen, and now Mordechai also refusing to bow down. So says Rav Lau, Ula, this is about 10 lines down on the right hand side. Domeh, it would seem, Shemitacha lifnei Asheta, in really go beneath the surface, Mitracheshe drama katana. I love that Hebrew word, drama. There's a little drama going on here. Bein Shnei Hasarim, between these two princes. Who are the princes? Haman and Mordechai. Haman ole ligdula. Haman is becoming, as you say, Moshe Grois, he's becoming the big guy. Mordechai nishar b'tafkido b'shar melech. And Mordechai remains in his position in the palace of the king. Al panav hasipur pashut. On the face of it, it seems to be quite a simple story. Hama mitnasei me'al kol asarim. Haman is elevated. He's waiting for people to bow down to him because he's got such a big ego. As is the custom in Persia. Mordechai over lachok. And Mordechai is breaking the law. Doesn't bow down. Amidah zu moreret et chamat Haman. Haman gets very angry. Umolida b'sofata pitarona sofi, and he makes the final solution, to quote the phrase, lashmid et kol yudim asher b'chol medinot achashverosh, to kill all the Jews. Hashmadat ha'am ba'a b'mefurash kitaguva. So Haman requesting or demanding the death of the Jewish people is a reaction. Lamidato etana v'ha geyesh of Mordechai is not bowing down to him. So the obvious question is, Ad shehaman eino kore la'am ha'mu'amad lashmada am Yisrael ha'yudim. It's almost as if Haman is more upset with Mordechai's personal chutzpah, his affront, his lack of dignity, his lack of respect to Haman, than at this point who Mordechai is. So it's, and remember we pointed this out, ela'am Mordechai, even when he says to the king that I want to bring a decree against Mordechai, or the people of Mordechai, he doesn't say Am Yisrael. It's Am Mordechai, because his beef is with Mordechai. His disagreement is a personal disagreement with Mordechai. But how do we really understand this? So says Rav Lau, he says there are three approaches. Number one is section A, Hagisha Hadatit. Right? You see A on the right hand side. Lo mishtachavim l'avodah zarah. As we said, Haman was wearing an idol around his neck. And Mordechai says, I'm not bowing down to this guy. He's wearing an avodah zarah. He's wearing an idol. Right? Little story. I went on a trip to the British Museum about 10 years ago with a rabbi taking people around the British Museum. And he said to us, he said that when you get to certain exhibits and you want to read the little plaque next to the exhibit, don't bow down forward. Because that exhibit may be a little idol from who knows when. So he said, what we've got to do is we've got to look at it sideways. You can't imagine the looks that we got. This group of 10 people going up to every exhibit going like this. Everybody thought that we were very, you know, that they thought this was a prank from the television, you know, that we're making fun of the whole thing. I'll never forget it, but he was dead serious. He said, don't bow down to it because it may be an avodah zarah. They found it in a dig somewhere. If you go to London, you must go to the British Museum. It's a must. Particularly to the Persian room. All this history is recorded there, including a big wall hanging of Achashverosh and Esther. They're all there. All right, it's all been recorded. And they found all these things in Persia. Unbelievable. What they've got over there in the British Museum is usually what they stole from everybody else. The Brits, British Empire, they stole everything. But there you go. I didn't say that. So it says like this. Listen to this. Hagishatatit. So we have the whole thing of a religious reaction that Mordechai has. I'm not bowing down to Haman. He's wearing the idol. Feh. I don't like this guy. You mustn't bow down to him. Look at the... Rav Lau, I'm not going to go through the next paragraph, but he says Mordechai reflects the three gentlemen jumped into the fire. They knew that tradition, Mishael, Azariah, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the three gentlemen that jumped into the fire in Babylon and they came out alive, and Mesirat Nefesh, and a religious stand against Haman. Says Rav Lau, the four lines at the bottom of the first column, Gisha Pashanit Zo, Mitalemet Legamre, but he says the problem with this approach is very limited. It doesn't take into account Mitafkido Sifruti Shalei Ruah Zeh B'Megillah. That when you look at the Megillah and try and understand what's going on in the flow of the story, this whole item of Mordechai not bowing down doesn't really fit in. Why? Hamadgish et habegiyah beish Haman. Because he says the story implies this was an affront to Haman, not an affront to what Haman represents as a religious icon, but it's an affront, it's an embarrassment to Haman himself. But Mashu Miyatzeg, not what he represents. Hey, may I reckon story shalo shaboni dom behemja. So basically what Rav Lau says is that it's very nice, and we all learn like this, that Mordechai doesn't bow down to what Haman is wearing, but what has that got to do with Haman? Why is that so bound up with the story is bound up between Mordechai and Haman so directly, and that became the focus of the story. Mordechai doesn't bow down to what Haman represents, but why are we saying it's that and not Haman himself? It's almost detracting from the fact that Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman himself, but only to what Haman is wearing. And is that really the story? Says Rav Lau, I'm not sure, because the story seems to imply there's something going on between Mordechai and Haman on a personal basis. It's not because I'm not bowing down to him because he's wearing something. I'm not bowing down to him because he is who he is. So what's going on here? So says Rav Lael B, look at section B, and he puts the religious comment to one side. He doesn't throw any of these ideas away, but he says there are different approaches. So again, the question why Mordechai did what he did, such an antagonistic thing to do, and he's bringing trouble on himself and the whole of the Jewish people. Would he be allowed to do such a thing? Should he have done it? And we're going to argue, well, obviously, religiously, that's what he did, because he wants Mordechai wants to make a statement. I don't bow down to the idol around his neck, but that's about the idol, not about Homer. Right? Could be any, could be a dummy, and the dummy's wearing an idol. He doesn't bow down to the dummy either. The reality of it is that, you know, there's more to it than just the necklace that Haman was wearing. So he says, you know what, let's look at section B very quickly. And he says, Gishalomit, Mordechai is a proud Jew. Right? This is what he calls a more Israeli explanation. He said there's two types of Jews in the world, according to the Torah. There's Yaakov and Yisroel. Same person. But when does Yaakov become Yisroel? Yaakov in Chutz La'aretz, he's outside Israel. And is Yisroel, he's the proud Jew in Israel. Right? Outside Israel, it's the Jew who is always oppressed, and he's always running away from the non-Jew, and it's Anatevka, and it's fiddle on the root, and it's that whole mentality. In Israel, it's the proud, upstanding, nationalistic Jew who says, you know, I'm here, I'm in my country, and everything else, and I'm making a stand on behalf of my nation. Not necessarily a religious stand, because many Jews in Israel are very nationalistic, and not religious, they're Zionists. So, essentially, maybe that's what's going on with Mordechai. Why is Mordechai not bowing down? Because he's saying, I represent my nation. I represent who I am in terms of Lu'umit, in terms of the nation, not necessarily religiously. I don't want to bow down to Haman because he represents the enemy. He represents Esau, and I represent Yisroel. And we know that one of the things that, and he brings it here from Midrash, Agadat Esther, if you look at section B, it says, the Benasha Rachel lo mishtachavel legoy. He's the son of a descendant of Rachel. And he does not bow down to the non-Jew. How do we know this? Amru lo, because the men in the palace said to Mordechai, Halo motzinu shavotech ishtachavel avotam. Your grandfather, your great-great-grandfather, Yaakov, bowed down to Esau many times, right? In that whole confrontation. So Amar Lahem, he said, no, Yaakov may have done it, but Binyamin, I am from the descendant of Benjamin, Ishumini. Mordechai is a Benjaminite. Where was Binyamin when Esau came to attack Yaakov's camp? Binyamin wasn't born yet. He was still in his mother's womb. He says, Binyamin Avi, my father, Binyamin, b'me'ei imo haya. He was still in his mother's womb. V'lo ishtachava, he did not bow down to Esau. And I represent my roots. I represent Binyamin. And therefore, he didn't bow down to Esau, I'm not bowing down to Haman. Unbelievable. And he says, k'shem shelo kara avi, just as my father did not bow down, this is the section B at the beginning, kach an lo echra ani. I am not going to bow down either. And he brings a whole discussion here on the page, which I'm not going to go into, between Rebbe Judah the Prince and Mark Antony. We know that Judah the Prince had a very close relationship with Mark Antony, Antoninus. And there's a whole midrash which he brings where Rebbe was very conciliatory towards Antoninus. It was a time when the Romans weren't so anti-Semitic, they weren't so against the Jews. Rebbe became very wealthy, he's a very rich man. He said he had food on his table which nobody else would have the whole year round. All right, nowadays you go to ShopRite, you get it the whole year round, but in those days you couldn't. And he would get stuff from all over the world being shipped to him, so that it would be on his table, it would be there. But Rebbe was an incredible, he really deserves more attention than we have time for. But the reality of it is, he said that Rebbe represents the kind of approach which was more of the Yaakov of giving homage, respect, etc., when it was necessary to cull favors. But there are situations, he says, when you have to be Yisrael. You've got to stand up. And you don't give in to the pressure from the non-Jew around you. Again, Mordechai Nilevich, the whole story of the Warsaw Ghetto. He would stand up to the Nazi, not because he's a very extreme religious person, but because he's a Jew. And as a Jew, he said, Jews should not be bowing down and giving in to that sort of intimidation. Very, very interesting. But again, Rav Lau said, turn over the page to page 2, and he says again, it's not clear that that's Mordechai's motivation. We can suggest that that's Mordechai's motivation, but you know what? There's a question about it. I'm not going to go through it. It's a whole section before, above section C. He's got a big question about it. Is that really the way that Mordechai would have behaved? You know, we're sort of suggesting something here for Mordechai, which may not necessarily be the case. Two approaches, the religious approach we have a problem with, and the nationalistic approach. Mordechai, the proud Jew, we also have a problem with, right? It doesn't necessarily fit in so well to the flow of the story. What Rav Lau is going to suggest, because what is the basic problem? It seems that all of this is very nice putting up kind of images of the people, but what about the personal interaction between Haman and Mordechai? What was that all about? What was going on? There's something really personal between these guys. Just by the way it says that, you know, you see the psukim. What is it? And at the point where Mordechai refuses to bow down, it's not even clear till the servants in verse 3 tell the king, and they bring the message, and Haman finds out, although Haman probably knows, that Mordechai is Jewish. It's not even clear that verse 2, where Mordechai is not bowing down, is because of the fact that he's Jewish. There seems to be something which, the news of Mordechai being Jewish, if you look at verse 3, at the bottom of page 1254, where it says, "Vayomer avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech le-Mordechai." They say to Mordechai, "Madu ata aver mitzvot ha-melech? Why do you go against the mitzvot of the king?" And it goes on, and basically... just one second. Yeah, and verse 6, Vayivez ve'inav lishloach yo b'Mordechai. What happened was that eventually Haman comes to a plan. The plan is that I'm going to do away with Mordechai, but big time. I can't just go to the king and say, kill Mordechai. We just learned Mordechai has got diplomatic immunity. He saved the life of the king. So Haman has to say, well, look, I can't kill him as an individual, but let's do a big plan. Get rid of all of his people, and he's going to be included. No question, like the story of the Barbanel. The Barbanel was, in 1492, the famous rabbi, was told by the queen and king of Spain, you can stay. All the Jews are leaving, but you can stay because we need you. You're running the country. And the Barbanel said, my people are going, I'm going. And he left. And of course, that was really one of the reasons why Spain has been in the doldrums for the last 500 years. They got rid of their Jews. The reality of it is that, you know, when it comes to this sort of thing, it is very, very interesting, sort of the way these decrees come about, the way that the story sort of unfolds. And there's no question that before we get to what we would recognize as the plot against the Jews, there is something going on between Mordechai and Haman, which leads Mordechai to be so aggressive. Our question just returns again and again. Why is he so aggressive to Haman? We said religiously maybe he's making a stand, or nationalistically he's making a stand. But that's kind of, you know, in the third person. What about the interaction between the two men? Here comes the bombshell. This is section C. We'll go through this, and I hope that this will give you something to think about for the rest of the week. Listen, if not longer. Section C, Agishai's story. Hareka Hatzvai. Now, Hezber HaShlishi, section C on page 2. He said there's a third explanation. La'akshanuto shel Mordechai keneged Haman. Why was Mordechai such an akshan? Such a, what's the word? A pain in the neck, right? Mit baseis al midrash muzah. He says we find a very strange midrash. Ha-midrash ma'asechet Megillah mevi sipur tamua mo. There's a whole story in the Gemara. V'zubo matu'ar. And it tells us shebechol pam shenitkalu Haman and Mordechai zeb zeb b'shah ha'ir. Whenever Mordechai and Haman met, hayu sholofim zel umat ze shtarei chov v'shtarei kniyah. They started taking out legal documents against each other. I've got a piece of paper which says this, says Mordechai. Haman says, I've got a piece of paper which says this, and they started showing documents. What's going on? You know, if they're going to duke it out. You know, have a fist fight. But they're showing documents? What sort of fight is this? Listen to this. Fascinating. We've got to go down to, where is it? 9 lines from the bottom of the page. He says, here comes the revelation of the whole Megillah. He says, Pamacha, and this is a midrash from, doesn't say where it's from, but again, it's mentioned in the Gemara. I think it's actually taken from Gemara Megillah. He says, once upon a time, Natan lahem ha-melech Mamon, King Achashverosh, when it came originally to some of the battles that he had in the early days, Marathon, 490, and Thermopylae, not so much that they evolved there, but Salamis, all those battles that we mentioned, King Achashverosh had to get generals in the army. So who did he have? He had two very high up generals. One was called Mordechai, and one was called Haman. They were both generals in the army. And the king, what did he do? Natan lehem ha-melech mamon. He gave both of these gentlemen money. V'shigram rashei gaiso dechvosh et ha-medina. And he sent them away to conquer through the army that they were responsible for, the troops that they had, to go and conquer another country. Both of them. Not al Haman chetz yishal mamon. So let's say it was $1 million. So Haman took half $1 million. V'achlo, and he went and partied. He spent it in Las Vegas or wherever, right? He decided, big deal. And velonishtai hemenu klum, nothing was left. You go to Las Vegas, you know, you put your money in, it's gone. Okay, that's Haman. And now, of course, he's got a problem because he's got an obligation to fight the war on behalf of the king. Ukeshabal lahotzi al balei amelchama lo biyadav klum, to pay mercenaries, which he had to do, no money. He's blown it. It's all in a Swiss bank account. So what's he going to do? By to Mordechai, so Haman says, I know I'm going to get money. I'll go to Mordechai. Because he's got the other half $1 million. Shekol ha-mamon ha-shalem biyado. Because he was always honest. There was no suggestion Mordechai was dishonest. And he has the other part of the money. Kashem shenot nalo ha-melech. As the king, I know, I got half and he got half and he still got his money. So amalo Haman la-Mordechai. So Mordechai was asked the following question by Haman. Halaveni min amomain zeh sheyesh bi adam. Give me a loan. I don't want to give, but you know, loan me the money that I need. Amalo. So Mordechai said, Eini malavach. I'm not going to give you a loan. I can't stand you. Ela imkein timkoli. You've got to make a deal with me. What's the deal? Bottom line on the right hand side. Timkoli. Listen to this. Nafshach le'evet. You're going to become my slave, my servant. I'm going to have a piece of paper which I'm going to get you to sign, which declares that you, Haman, are subservient to me. This is Mordechai's deal. It's in the Midrash. Unbelievable story. And Kibela Nafsho, Haman says, you know, what can I do? So he did it, signed the piece of paper, and he becomes Mordechai's servant. Now, think about this. Look at the final column here. And we're going to finish with this column. Katav lehachi b'shtar. What was in the document that was written? Haman avda de Mordechai. Haman, the servant, the slave of Mordechai. The wonder he didn't like Mordechai. In a way, I'm not going to feel sorry for Haman, but I understand. So he said, Zabin nafshei. He sold himself to Mordechai b'tulma de Nahama, for a loaf of bread. Literally. In other words, he sold out. As far as of course, doesn't mean Haman was a good guy because he blew the money, you know, on his own special needs, you know, as you want to call it that. You know, he basically wasted the money. And therefore, Haman is now a slave to Mordechai. And he could be going back to the Battle of Marathon, 490. So even 10 years before all of this stuff blew up, more than 10 years, we already got a relationship between Mordechai and Haman, which is one of master and slave. Now, V'hainu deka'oma, it's about the fifth line down, because the brackets is just the translation of the Aramaic. Fifth line down. Hainu deka'oma le Mordechai lahoman. Now this is what Mordechai says to Haman. Avda dekoni nichse, avda deman. Nichse deman. If a slave acquires something, who does it belong to? Does it belong to the slave or to the owner? Obviously it belongs to the owner. And this is it. And the bracket, Zeh shomar l'Mordechai l'Haman, Eved shekona nechasim, Eved shelmi, nechasim shelmi. Who does the money belong to? In other words, Haman, you are my slave. Now, think about this, because this creates a personal relationship between Mordechai and Haman, which is what chapter 3 is beginning to tell us, and it's unraveling at that point. Cheref dimyono, listen to this. And this is again a comment of Rav Lan, so interesting. He says, and I'll read it through. Cheref dimyono mefutach shel darshan. He said, look, the rabbi here has got a very interesting imagination. Muzruto shel midrash, and this midrash is certainly very strange. But if shalish tameshbo, we can use the information. Kedelet sayed demut speculative, a wonderful Hebrew word. We can speculate on Mordechai v'Amon. What's going on between these two men? Shnei banim mishpachot mahagrim. They're both from families of refugees. Haman was also not Persian in his. He was Agagi, right? Descending from Agag, the story with Shaul Hamela. Agag was not from Persia. So Mordechai is a refugee, came from Israel, for his family, and Haman is also a refugee. His family came from who knows where, somewhere in the Middle East. So Bikshu Lishtalei B'chayei Paras, the modernity, they want to become part of Persian, modern Persian society. Heim Itchanchu B'marechet Atzvayit. So they both go to the army, to the academy, West Point. What better place to become fully fledged member of the country? You go to the academy, right? What's it called in England? It's got another name. I've forgotten the name of the place. Sandhurst. Same thing as West Point. Tipsu v'alu b'shasheret ha'pikud. And they start becoming good soldiers and they become officers. And up and up and up. Al pi ha'midrash hazeh, according to what we just said in the Midrash, Mordechai einu ish el beit ha'midrash. Mordechai is certainly not a man of the house of learning yet. Eino anshei knesset hagdola, he's not a man of the great assembly, as we always understood him to be. Ve'eino rabam shekol b'nei ha'golan, he's not the chief rabbi of all the people in the diaspora. Hu ben l'mishpacha, he's just a son of a family. Shebiksha litama b'tzamer shilton ha'parsi, he wants to go as high as he can in the Persian hierarchy. B'talich tzmichuton, and with the way that he's doing it, hu nishma mikol zihui am Ha'am Yudin. He's not even telling people that he's Jewish. They'll find out. But that's not his main thing. Kol shiyuch yikalkel lo et ha'kirira. If they know he's Jewish, he's never going to go past a certain point. So he keeps it under wraps. Now listen to this. B'milchama gadola shel Achashverosh. With this incredible war of Achashverosh, I said Thermopylae, and it may actually be Marathon, 490 BC or 480, whichever one it was. These two gentlemen, Mordechai and Haman, they were officers. Hovilu et gaisot bekravot, and they took the army into battle. Al pi midrash karikaturi shalana, and according to what we just saw in the midrash, Haman nikshal b'masimato, Haman failed. Lo viseit et atachmoshet v'aspaka, he didn't keep an eye on the money. He spent all the money on himself. You can't go into war without guns or without swords or without anything like that. He's got a problem, Haman. Who ponen leMordechai leEzra? So who helps him? Mordechai. Ach, Mordechai matnet Ezrato bekam. Mordechai makes a condition. Shehaman yeye kafuf lo. Haman is going to be subservient to Mordechai. B'sofo shel davar shneim chozrim leShushan haBira. Move the clock on another few years. They both come out of the army. They go back to Shushan. La'achash not milchamat, after all of this war, etc. Poshtim and madehem, they take off their officer's uniform. Shalab shitat amadim, hu kiyadu lekore Yisraeli, shalab haknisa lepolitika. Like in Israel, when they stop being soldiers, they become politicians. Right? You wonder why Israel politics is so up the creek, is so messed up. Because all these guys are in the army. When you're in the army, you learn how to be an army man. And all of a sudden, the politician, you've got to wheel and deal. Army men find it very hard to do that. So, third election coming up in Israel. It's crazy. It's crazy what's going on over there. But this explains a lot of the background. Think about it. It makes perfect sense. It's just very difficult. How do you run a country like that? But there you go. He says, "Bekach motzi matzma Mordechai v'amam b'tkufa mavak." Now they're fighting Mordechai and Haman, not to be the general of the year, but to be the administrator of the year, because they're both trying to rise up in the administration. Shushan HaBira, Haman ole legdula. Haman seems to do better. He seems to be a bigger schmooze, as they say. Ach Mordechai lo mafsik laskir lo et oto krav avud. And when it comes to the discussion between Haman and Mordechai, Mordechai says, Haman, you're such a knack, you're such a great guy. Remember our deal. Remember what deal we made once upon a time. Shebo machar Haman atzmo b'kikrod lechem. You sold yourself to me for a loaf of bread. Et hazikaron hazeh, and Haman, it sticks in his throat. He says, Haman mevakesh limcha, Haman wants to push this all out of existence. He doesn't want to deal with this anymore. Hu mishtokek la'alim et Mordechai ha-mitzik. He wants to get rid of Mordechai. Mordechai mitzido lo yichra v'lo yishtachva. How did he want to subjugate Mordechai? By getting him to bow down. End of agreement. Mordechai bows down to Haman. I'm the master. Mordechai is the eved, the slave. Mordechai says, no way, Hosea, I'm not doing this. Unacceptable. We've got the documentation to prove it. You know, go jump. And he says, if we understand this, then the whole story, the beginning of chapter 3, takes on a whole new meaning. What is going on initially between Mordechai and Haman is a personal vendetta which had been around for a long period of time. Mordechai was, for Haman, the ultimate pain in the neck. Right? He is representing everything that I want to become. Mordechai is putting a stop to it. Because Mordechai is saying to the whole world, Haman is a slave. And I want to be the greatest person in Persia, number two to the king of Persia, the king of the world. And Mordechai is stopping me. So what is Haman's grief? It's not necessarily with the people of Mordechai, but it's with Mordechai. Mordechai himself. Look at this last paragraph. Al-Pi Pirush Azeh, according to what we're now saying, that the whole thing is to do with the historical situation. Amidatosha Mordechai, Eina Kashura. The whole rebellion of Mordechai, not bowing down, doesn't connect. Ki hu zeh, the Gezerat Dat, is not a question of religion. V'gam ein ba'muma mizkifu akum alumit. It's not a question of Jewish national pride. Nothing to do with it. Hu adayan menukam zeuto yudit. Mordechai seems as yet to have discovered all of the connection, the Jewish connection, which comes up now in chapter 3 and beyond. He's hiding the fact that he's Jewish at this point of the story. All they want to do is go as high as they can in the Persian government. That's why he's sitting in the palace of the king. That's a sign of acceptance in the government. Nothing to do with being a very wise and learned Jew. It's to do with the fact that he is raising himself in the civil service of Persia. Umakpid. And therefore he's particular. Ish lo yidad zeuta amitit. He told Esther, don't say you're Jewish. And he's not telling people that he's Jewish. Has he got a long white beard? Maybe not. Maybe he's got a short beard. Maybe he's got no beard at all. Maybe, you know, who knows what he looks like at this point. Hamidash shalom. This is very controversial. I have to tell you, it's not pashut. And I warned you at the beginning. One's view of the whole story does change a little bit when we go with this approach. But boy, does this become a powerful story. Because when Mordechai flips and becomes that Jewish leader, it's so powerful. Because, you know, you never know where the voice is going to come from. In London yesterday, the chief rabbi made an article in the Times newspaper. And the chief rabbis are famous in England for one thing, never getting involved with politics. A bit like here, no church and state. And the chief rabbi wrote an article in the Times newspaper yesterday where he said the Jewish community is afraid of the candidate, a guy called Corbyn, running the Labour Party, and you shouldn't vote for him. And the BBC went crazy. He was on the headlines of the BBC yesterday, the whole day. Chief rabbi and other rabbis, how can the rabbi mix in politics? And they all said the same thing, that this is an extraordinary situation where I know it's to do with religion, but in this case it's about what could be if this man becomes the prime minister, what he will bring into the country and allow to go on in his own party. All of a sudden it'll be allowed to say things which they already say, which we found in the protocols of Zion, all those horrible things that we know from Jewish history. It's all coming back again. And the leader's doing nothing. The chief rabbi was prepared to take the flak for what he said in the Times newspaper, like the New York Times equivalent. Unbelievable. So you've got to make a stand. But what we're saying here is that Mordechai is all about his elevation at the moment, not necessarily his Jewishness, but it's his position in the country. And he says the last five lines, ומקפיד איש לא ידע זהות אמיתית. המידה שלו אינה מידה לאומית, אלא אישית. It's all personal at this point. שמסתיר רקע משותף ידוע לו למען. He's hiding the whole history between him and Haman. But you know what? Haman knows. ורק לאחר, now, when we read the story and the servants find out of the difference between Mordechai and Haman, just going to finish, then the servants מפצירים בו שיפסיק את ההפגנה. They say to Mordechai, stop it. Don't do this anymore because you're in danger. Hem negashim al Haman mechapsim et nekudat ha-torfa shel Mordechai. And they go to Haman and say, we can get rid of Mordechai for you. You know how you get rid of him? Not personal attack on Mordechai, on his people. Am Mordechai. What have we done today? We've discovered that in fact Mordechai is not a religious fight at the beginning. It's not even the proud Jew versus, you know, the Yisrael versus the Esau. You know what this is all about? It's about an old vendetta, a personal vendetta that went on from the army, carried on for many, many years. And at this point, it came to a head because Haman was on the ascendant. Mordechai is there the whole time and is a total affront to Haman. And you know what happens when, in this case, Haman turns around and says, got to get rid of this guy once and for all. I can't kill him. I can't throw him out because he's protected by the king. That was the story of Bigtan and Teresh. He got diplomatic immunity. So how do I get rid of him? You know what I'm going to do? Am Mordechai. It's not Am Yisrael at this point. It's Am Mordechai. I'll get rid of his people. And if I get rid of his people, he's going to be included, like the Barbanel. He went with the Jews. He didn't have. He could have had diplomatic immunity. He stayed in Spain. You know what he did? My people are leaving Spain. I'm going with them. And that was the same story here. With this approach, the whole story is just phenomenal. And of course, the question still now, we've answered Ibn Ezra's question, which is, how can Mordechai make the dangerous stand against Haman? And the answer is, because at this point, Mordechai is not considering his position as a Jew, he's not considering even his position of himself, except he's considering the fact that Haman is his slave. I'll tell you something really cute to end, which is that we have a tradition. It was already in Eastern Europe, that when you want to test out a pen or something, you write the Haman on your shoe. All right? And there's a thing in halacha that you want to do mechiyat amalek, you write the word Haman, and you rub your shoe in the dirt, and it rubs out the ink. Say the rabbis, you know what happened here? Whenever Haman came to Mordechai, you know what Mordechai did? He lifted his shoe. And on the shoe underneath, it said the word Eved. And Mordechai did this, and he put up his shoe, and Haman sees the word Eved, slave. And Haman goes berserk. Haman goes crazy. You know, where's this man going to leave me alone? When am I ever going to get rid of this man? And it's so personal. That's what's so interesting. What we're going to see in chapter 4, we're going to finish chapter 3 next week, please go. But chapter 4 is when it becomes from being personal to becoming much more global. Because once it becomes an attack on the Jewish people, then all of a sudden Mordechai and Esther become the Jewish leaders. But that's going to happen later. Wow. Everyone's looking a bit shell-shocked. I apologize. What an interesting approach. Isn't this interesting? I mean, really. Something unique. Something different. It answers a lot of questions. It probably throws up many more questions as well. Thank you for listening, everybody. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Enjoy. Turkey was never my forte, so I can't say I'm going to enjoy some turkey, but whatever, mitzvah shem, something nice. Thank you, everybody. Have a good day. Thank you.